Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they're counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed. Our mission is therefore to look behind the headlines to know who is working against our interests, understand why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. It's actually caring. The wisest thing we can do. Today in our second hour, we're going to have a conversation with IQ Al Rasooli. He has asked today that we compare America's tizzy fit over Russia and Crimea with what the United States did in his homeland, Iraq. And then in our third hour, we're going to return to the sweeping prophecy that Yahweh provided regarding the days that we are living in and how the Syrian civil war was going to serve as the catalyst for the tribulation and for many unfortunate events, many of which are going to affect this nation as we move forward in time over the next 19 to 20 years. If you'd like to participate in this program, we'd encourage you to do so. It's 877-300-7645. I had initially intended to begin this program on the budget of the United States because it is such a harbinger of things to come, but Aaron, who produces this show, is fixated on, I just can't get enough of the latest on the Malaysian airline flight that has fallen off radar screens and wants to know, where in the world is Waldo? And so he asked me this morning before we began the show, what's new? And what's new is that they're now using the Doppler effect to determine the speed and direction of the aircraft. Evidently, there was a British satellite somewhere on the equator that received partial information from the Malaysian flight. And that based upon the Doppler effect, now what the Doppler effect says that if an object is moving away from you, the wavelength is stretched. That's why you get a lower sound when a train whistle is blowing, but the train is heading away from you. And why you get a higher pitched sound or a shrinking of the wavelength when it is moving to you. It's the Doppler effect that was used to determine that scientists were wrong and that Yahweh was right, although God was not given credit. That the universe is expanding, which means that it had a beginning, because the stars in the universe are all moving away from us, which indicates that at one time they were much closer together, which means at one time they were in one place, which means there was a big bang. That is the Doppler effect. So based on the Doppler effect now, they're saying that the airplane was traveling at a greater rate of speed than they originally had thought, and that, therefore, it ran out of fuel more quickly. And, therefore, it is 700 miles from where we've had the game of competing satellites, I spy, you spy, who can spot the remains of the airplane. And it strikes me that first of all, the Doppler effect is an interesting phenomenon. Using it to calculate the speed and direction of an airplane, when you're dealing with a satellite that is not set up to do any of those things, is a bit of a stretch. And in addition to that, it's a bit of a stretch to say that there would be a 700-mile difference based upon the speed of the aircraft. Owning and flying a jet, one of the things that I recognize is that, yes, the airplane will go a little further if you pull back on the throttles and you give it less jet A to those engines. Over a longer period of time, the airplane will fly further. But the difference is really negligible. It's the reason why few jet operators pull the throttles back at cruise, because while you will elongate the time that you're in the air, you have a very de minimis effect on your overall distance that the aircraft can travel. I had originally speculated the day that this aircraft went off the grid that the highest likelihood is that there was a decompression of the cabin. And that as we have learned, many of the commercial pilots are inadequately trained to deal with manual events. They have become video players. They have become technology managers. And if they can't, if something happens that's outside of, I'm going to turn to this dial and push this button and monitor this system, they have proven inadequate. The Korean crew couldn't land an airplane on a standard approach in San Francisco. If the auto land capability, which was enabled by the ILS, was unavailable to them, they had no idea whatsoever how to maintain a stabilized approach. Well, in this case, you really don't have much time to get your act together relative to an oxygen mask if an airplane flying at 35,000 feet were to lose pressurization. And we know this airplane went up to as high as 45,000 feet, which is several thousand feet above its design ceiling. At 45,000 feet, you'd have about 5 seconds, probably, of useful consciousness to get your oxygen mask on. And, you know, there's some things you got to do. You got to remove the headsets. You've got to remove your glasses if you're wearing them. You got to locate the headsets. You've got to don a, you follow a certain procedure to get the mask over your face. And if you didn't previously check to see if the oxygen bottle was full and check to see if the distribution knobs for emergency oxygen were in the right position, you know, then you're in a real pickle. And if you haven't trained to do this, you didn't notice that, oh boy, we've got a problem in the cabin, it could be a slower decompression as opposed to a rapid decompression, you're just going to go nighty-night. It's over. You're just going to fall asleep. Not enough oxygen, and it will occur very quickly. I think that's what happened. I think that everybody fell asleep on that airplane, and it was the Payne Stewart situation. It continued to fly until it was out of fuel, and that all we're going to find when we find it, if we find it, is that there was no malfeasance here. There was a decompression of the cabin, and the pilots and crew fell asleep. They had no idea what happened. Well, now that we've taken care of Aaron's curiosity, let's go to the item in the news. This was actually published about 2 weeks ago, but other events have precluded me sharing this with you. It reads as follows. President Obama's latest budget proposal paints a troubling picture of America's fiscal future. Here is a startling snapshot. I'm here to tell you before I share this snapshot with you that America's fiscal future is extraordinarily bleak. We're in a death spiral. It's what we have done to ourselves is irreversible. Apart from whatever Russia does, whatever China does, apart from whatever the NSA does, apart from whatever the Federal Reserve does from this point on, apart from Obamacare, apart from welfare and defense spending, apart from whatever Muslims do around the world in terms of acts of terror and acts of war, apart from all of that, America is doomed financially. What we have done to ourselves is irrecoverable. It is irreversible. We owe over $17 trillion. That's over 100% of GDP. But in addition to being in debt, over 100% of GDP, over $17 trillion, by far more than any other country on earth, we have become the largest debtor on earth. In unfunded mandates, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, as well as government employee pension plans, the United States is in debt another $45 billion. And it is those pension plans that bankrupt nations. It's what has bankrupted the Ukraine. It is what has bankrupted the state of California, for example. It is what bankrupted the city of Detroit. And so these matters are irresolvable. We are way too far in debt. And it's going to become cataclysmic. Because right now, we have so tweaked the nose of our condescending rhetoric, as the Chinese says, our constant jabbering and hypocritical tone. It's caused the Chinese to say, you know, we're just not buying any more of your treasury bills. We're not going to fund your debt anymore. They're not increasing the amount that they hold, and the amount that they hold as a percentage of our overall debt is shrinking. Japanese have determined the same thing. It's why quantitative easing exists. It's why the Federal Reserve is the only viable source of U.S. debt financing. But let's think about what quantitative easing is. It's as if you had a mortgage, and your mortgage each year was required you to pay $1 trillion. You needed $1 trillion beyond your income to pay your mortgage. And that rather than coming up with the money somehow, working extra hard, cutting expenses in other places so that you could make your mortgage payment, instead you pull out a piece of paper and a Crayola, and you write on this piece of paper, I owe you $1 trillion, and you hand it to the bank and say, here, take this in lieu of actual money. Take this in lieu of currency. And the following year, you pull out another Quran and you say, here, take this. I promise to pay you $1 trillion. And how are you going to pay the $1 trillion? This year's and last year's and the previous year's $1 trillion? Simply pull out another Quran and write on another piece of paper. Here's my promise to pay. $1 trillion more. It's all make-believe. It's fantasy. It's a fiat currency that has gone awry. On this particular article, as they report the dire situation, the first line says, by 2024, the national debt will rise from $17.4 trillion to $25 trillion. Oh, it will be much greater than that. And we'll explain why after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. This article forecasts that by 2020 is just 6 years from now, U.S. taxpayers would be paying more on interest on the existing debt than the entire defense budget. Defense budget right now is about $700 billion, and they're saying that within 6 years we're going to be paying more than $600 billion on, in interest. At 6 years, the U.S. deficit will be well over $20 trillion. Now, at 5% interest, which would be laughably low, considering the bankrupt nature of America and the fact that there are no international takers to fund our debt, at just 5% interest, that's $1 trillion a year just to pay the interest on the debt. But when you look at countries that are essentially bankrupt, that are begging for money, as the situation is going to be for the United States, when it's obvious that they're going to have a very difficult time, if not impossible time, to pay that debt back, when there is considerable risk in association with the debt, then the absolute lowest you'll ever see interest rates is 10%. And 10% means that just debt service as part of the U.S. budget will be $2 trillion a year. That will add $2 trillion a year to the deficit just in interest. That's why it's a death spiral. This is something that cannot be resolved. Now, part of the reason, too, for the interest at 10% is that with quantitative easing and with the overall amount of money circulating in the economy increased by the Federal Reserve, we have substantially devalued our currency. You know, that story that I said about, you have a $1 trillion mortgage payment and you can't make the payment. You don't have any cash to make the payment. No one will loan you any money to make it. So what you do is you pull out a Crayola and you write on a piece of paper, $1 trillion here. Take this piece of paper with $1 trillion written on it with a Crayola, and then we'll meet next year. There is more harm here than just the illusion that your debts have been serviced. And that is that you've devalued your currency because you've now increased the money supply by that $1 trillion. That's what quantitative easing does. And if you had, let's just use a figure of $10 trillion available to pay for all of the goods and services in the economy, to value all the goods and services in the economy, and then somebody artificially says, you know, rather than $10 trillion, I want to make it $20 trillion. We're just going to instantly say that we're going to double the amount of currency in the economy. What that does is it devalues the currency relative to the goods and services in the economy. They are now, while they're worth the same, valued against that currency, it takes twice as much of that currency to purchase them. That means that they have, relative to the currency, where it was, lost half of their value. And when you have an inflating of the currency, the only way that somebody who has purchased goods and services, owns goods and services, owns goods, for example, owns assets, can keep those assets from deteriorating in value is to have them inflate. And interest is a means to compensate a lender for inflation. So it's going to happen. Interest rates are going to rise appreciably. It's going to be 5% with $1 trillion added to the debt every year, to 10% with $2 trillion added to the debt every year. We're going to do what in business we call the hockey stick approach. You know, the blade of the stick has a subtle upright angle. The top of that blade has a subtle upright angle, and then the stick itself goes not quite vertical, but certainly approaching vertical. Well, that's what's going to happen as it relates to the debt. They say that by 2017, just 3 years from now, interest payments will be bigger than the entire budget for Medicaid. Now, that's a bit misleading because it's Medicaid and Medicare combined that are the largest and fastest growing aspect of the U.S. federal spending, and that Medicaid alone misrepresents the collective problem we have with healthcare and the fact that our spending on healthcare between Medicare and Medicaid is going to increase appreciably as a factor of ADA. This article reads, despite Democratic claims that Obama has tackled the deficit, the debt continues to grow. And it is growing very quickly. And every year the debt grows, interest on that debt also grows. And it doesn't just grow at the same pace that the debt grows. You know, this is not a situation where you're paying interest one day on $10 trillion and the next day you're paying interest on $20 trillion, although that is the case. But when you have $20 trillion in debt, the interest necessary to compensate a lender for the deterioration of your currency by the inflation of your currency and for the risk associated with the unlikelihood you'll ever be able to pay back that $20 trillion causes the rate on the increased amount to increase even faster as a percentage of what it previously was than the amount itself. And so we are really in quite a bind, and you've got the fastest growing part of the U.S. deficit, Medicaid and Medicare. As a direct result of the Affordable Care Act, now poised to increase at a much faster rate than they were growing previously, and it previously was the fastest growing aspect of government spending. So we have a rather catastrophic rendezvous here. And, you know, you've got the hawks on the right side saying, don't you dare cut America's military spending. And you've got the bleeding heart liberals on the other. Don't you dare cut the entitlements. And the fact is that unless America were to cut both, in fact, to cut the entire federal budget by 20% a year for 5 or 6 years in a row, ending up eventually at about 10% of the current size, then there isn't any chance of resolving this issue. And even if the federal government was decreased by 20% a year for 5 or 6 years in a row, even if that were to occur, even if the government were to instantly resolve all of the constraints that it has on businesses, and all of the penalties and all of the burdens that it places on business, particularly employee costs and taxation-related costs. Even if it were to remove all of those and actually encourage people to start businesses, even if that were to occur, there is no possible way to pay off or even to pay down this deficit. We've created a situation from which there is no escape. What do you think, Glenn, who was called in here from Philadelphia? Is the deficit resolvable?
Hello. Hello, Yada. Good morning. Yes, I know what you were reading in 1993.
What's that?
Harry Figge's bankruptcy in 1995. You mentioned the hockey stick curve.
Yeah.
And Harry Figge was part owner of the Sherwood Hockey Equipment Company. That's why he had a hockey stick curve.
You know, my hockey stick reference is actually, you give me too much credit in having read Figge's book. I had a CFO in previous.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second.
Yes.
If you could disconnect and reconnect, we're just showing some frame loss so the listeners are going to have trouble understanding you.
Okay.
And then, Glenn, if you just want to take over for a minute or two while Yada reconnects.
Oh, well, I can just keep talking? Okay, yep. Oh, very good. I thought he was talking about me, but that's fine. All righty, very good. The book that I had just spoken to Yada about him reading was published in 1993, and it was authored by a man named Harry Figge, and it was called Bankruptcy 1995, and I don't have the rest of the title, something to the effect of the coming collapse of America and how to stop it. And there was another book written by a prominent Christian author at the time called The Coming Economic Earthquake by a man named Larry Burkett. And those two books both outlined these principles about which Yada is talking, about how exponential growth eventually sets in with the debt when you're using a fiat currency coupled with fractional reserve banking. And so what happens is you don't pay down the debt. You add your additional deficit onto the debt every year, and this just grows and grows and grows until it begins to grow so rapidly that it's utterly unrecoverable no matter what you do. And so there's nothing unpredictable about this. This is we've really been in a pickle for a very long time, and economists have been decrying this for a long time. People, as you know, as Yada said, they just keep getting out their crayon and writing IOU. And as long as nothing in the real physical world, hits us hard, as long as we're eating, drinking, able to be merry, watch sports, go to the mall, watch movies, and maintain our lifestyle, becomes just so immersed in the maintenance of our lifestyle, which is a thin veneer on top of the overall economy, that we don't realize that the whole foundations could crumble beneath us. And that's sort of what's happened and where we find ourselves now. It's certainly not a matter of good stewardship. We've also added the new element of derivatives, such as these, the mortgage fraud that we've seen, with collateralized debt obligations and that sort of thing. And the insurance policies to supposedly insure them. This is just nothing but add insult to injury and heap ever greater burdens onto this house of cards that we built for ourselves. And so I can sort of imagine that this might all come tumbling down quite badly when the time approaching, you know, the coming of Yahusha and the beginning of the tribulation, the beginning of the 7-year period of the 70th week of Daniel or the tribulation. Certainly, we know that the Bible talks about a time when it will take a day's wages just to earn enough grain, you know, to eat, let alone have surplus discretionary income to do other things such as do entertainment or anything like that. But, all right, I'll turn this back to you, Yada.
I was going to say that my hockey stick illustration came from a CFO of a former business that I was in who just loved hockey. But it is it's used prevalently in business and economic circles to describe the kind of situation that we're experiencing right now with the U.S. debt and with servicing that debt, whereas you have a fairly steady upward increase in debt or interest payments on debt, and then you hit a point where the
it's parabolic,
absolutely, and becomes uncontrollable in terms of the situation, and that's where we are right now in terms of America's deficit. And you know, when you look at countries like Greece that that are in such dire straits, even look at the Ukraine. America's deficit is much greater than theirs in aggregate numbers, and in some cases, much greater than the Ukraine's, even as a percentage of GDP, of gross domestic product. So we've reached a point of no return, and our constant jabbering against countries that are that don't have any debt, like China, and well, Japan is now beginning to create debt, Russia, but our constant animosity towards those who actually could service our debt is going to preclude them from doing so.
Right, exactly. The which obviously runaway. And any time you couple a fiat currency with a usurious interest rate and fractional reserve banking, it's a mathematical certainty from the very beginning there is more money in circulation than there is to pay back the system. So it is virtually unrecoverable from day one.
Yeah, I think that was a realization the moment we went to a fiat currency, and much of the world followed suit and went to a fiat currency. What a fiat currency means is that rather than the currency being based upon a tangible asset for centuries around the world and for well over 150 years in America. Even in our Constitution, there is nomenclature which speaks of establishing the rates of exchange, the standards, the weights and measures as it relates to the currency, which means that the currency is backed by either gold or silver of some precious asset, a precious metal, and that the currency is redeemable in that metal, which means that it is a certificate and equivalent to that asset. But what happened was
I thought it was backed by collateralized debt obligations insured by credit default swaps.
Well, that's what fiat money is. So
No, that's the worst. That's derivatives. I was being facetious.
Okay, all right. So what we have now is a fiat currency as opposed to a currency that is actually backed by a tangible asset. You know, there is no gold in Fort Knox. And even when there was gold in Fort Knox, it represented an infinitesimal percentage of the currency. And so we're now in a position where the dollar bill that you hold, it's no longer an asset. It is no longer backed by an asset. It's a debt instrument.
Right.
And it's based upon the debt that is imposed upon the U.S. taxpayer by the Federal Reserve. Would it enable...
And by your favorite word, Yada. It's backed by your favorite word. Faith.
Faith. Right. That's all it's backed by. And when something is backed by faith, when it's a belief system that enables something to function, what that means is that not only will it fall apart if you take the time to know the mechanism, if you understand what's happening, your faith in the mechanism dissipates. You know, knowledge and understanding always trump faith. And that's the reason why religious people, for example, who are faith-based, are so resilient to evidence and reason, so opposed to evidence and reason, because evidence and reason always destroys faith. A fiat currency is entirely faith-based, because you must believe that it has value, when in fact it has no value. It is simply a dead instrument.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I want to thank Glenn for carrying that last segment as we had issues with internet connectivity. I do want to change the topic. Glenn, please feel free to chime in on this one. I try to take Yahweh's perspective as it relates to all items in the news, and that's particularly true as it relates to anti-Semitism. You know, while this story is not about the Ukraine, the moment we saw that the uprising was occurring in the Ukraine, and I heard Putin's assessment of it, referring to it as a pogrom, and then looked up what pogrom meant and the history of the pogroms in the Ukraine, and found that they are amongst the most viciously anti-Semitic people on earth, my affection, my affinity for them dropped through the floor. I'm not much to help those that hate the chosen people. Now, I understand that Jews have done some things that hasn't made them very endearing. I'm with the antagonists in that regard, but you know, it is extraordinarily counterproductive to oppose those whom God loves. Well, this is a story about Saudi Arabia. A D.C.-based reporter for the Jerusalem Post, who is Jewish racially, but is an American citizen, not an Israeli citizen, was blocked from covering President Obama's current visit to Saudi Arabia. He was refused a visa, which, of course, drew objections from the White House. Not enough of an objection for the White House to cancel its trip, however. Our morals don't go that deep. Michael Wilner, the Washington bureau chief for the English language Israeli newspaper, had sought to travel to Saudi Arabia on Wednesday. His job is to cover the White House. He has been cleared as a presidential journalist. And so the paper that he worked for, the Jerusalem Post, one of the best newspapers in the world, had plans to send him to the Middle East to follow the president's travels. In fact, he was invited to fly on Air Force One. But Wilner, who is the newspaper's White House correspondent, found out early this week that he was denied an entry visa. Saudi Arabia and Israel do not have diplomatic relations. Wilner, however, is not an Israeli citizen and has never lived in Israel. And so Saudi Arabia can't fall back on, well, you know, we can't approve an Israeli passport because we don't have diplomatic relationship with Israel. He doesn't have an Israeli passport. This quote from Wilner: "I am an American journalist, an American citizen, covering the travel of an American president. I consider it unfortunate that Saudi Arabia would deny a legitimate reporter such as myself the ability to complete that work, much less one properly credentialed in the White House press corps, expressly invited on the trip.
I have little doubt that my access was denied either because of my media affiliation or because of my religion. It is a grave disappointment and a lost opportunity for the kingdom. Now, why wouldn't the United States then rail against Saudi Arabia? Why are we railing against Putin in Crimea instead of this kind of behavior in Saudi Arabia? You know, in Crimea, the citizens of Crimea expressed their will to 97% of them saying, you know, we don't want any part of the gang rule, that mob mentality that's emanated out of the Ukraine, where the popularly elected leader was driven out of town with threats that they were going to kill him. And we would much prefer to be reintegrated into the Russian Federation. We don't want to be part of a deadbeat mentality that is dependent on handouts of the Ukraine. We'll be part of Russia. But here, a journalist, an American citizen, is denied entry into Saudi Arabia because of his religion. And we partner with these people? U.S. officials have voiced concerns to the Saudis about Wilner's treatment. That's it. We are deeply disappointed that this credible journalist was denied a visa. We will continue to register our serious concerns about this unfortunate decision, said the National Security Council spokesperson. National Security Council spokesperson. Not the White House. Not the State Department. Not a senator. Not a congressman. The National Security Council? We'll be back in a moment.